That should put you in a good mood to start the show today. Tiny Bubbles, Connie Francis singing there. What a great way to start as we talk about bubbles and carbonation and how it works. And we'll take up some other science issues, too, with our guest today, Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. He's a national proponent for science and education. So we're going to talk with him about the science behind those bubbles, just as a fun way to start today. And we'll talk about other science and climate-related topics as well with him. Certainly love to hear from you. You can become part of the conversation by calling us. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back.
I'm always happy to be here, Larry. You're always bubbling with enthusiasm. That's what everyone says about you. When I run into them, they tell me, you're going to be on the Larry Miller show again? He's such a wonderful host. And Larry, you cover so many science topics and other cultural topics. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, it was kind of fun to think about talking about bubbles. Bubbles are fun. Everybody loves bubbles, I think.
Yeah.
And you look at bubbles, you drink a glass of champagne, you don't think about where the bubbles came from to begin with.
Well, after a while, you stop thinking about much of anything when you drink the champagne. But we have to be careful about alcohol consumption. So, yes, bubbles are all around us. Actually, they are part of the vernacular that we use. You know, they're bubbles in the stock market. They're bubbles in the economy and so on. But in science, you know, not just in science. When you boil water, you see some bubbles. They're not air bubbles. They are water bubbles. Although air dissolves in water very, very slightly, if you open the faucet and fill a glass with water, you see some bubbles, especially if the faucet has aeration in it.
Yeah, filter on it.
Yeah. If it doesn't have that and you wait a little bit until the glass warms up to room temperature, you see tiny bubbles. Those are air bubbles. We see them because they have come out of the liquid. Air and other gases are not very soluble. They don't dissolve in water very much. Some dissolve because they react chemically, but air bubbles don't. We all know about soap bubbles, beautiful floating soap bubbles. You blow air into them, and you form a very thin skin. It's spherical. All bubbles are spherical. And part of the joy of watching soap bubbles is to look at the colors and to look at how they float downward until they pop. Sometimes bubbles can change in size, and that's because of the properties of the skin that surrounds the gas that's captured inside.
They don't get bigger, they get smaller. Or do they get bigger too?
Well, the next time you boil water, if you boil it in a tall vessel, you will see tiny bubbles at the bottom. And then as the bubbles rise, they get bigger. And they get closer to the surface, they get smaller. But watching champagne bubbles, that's a beautiful sight, too. The bubbles form trains that move up smoothly. And the temperature of the champagne has to be just right in order for us to enjoy it. We use champagne to mark all kinds of celebrations, all kinds of occasions. And as with all alcoholic beverages, Larry, I have to say this again. I always say this. Enjoy the beverage, but be moderate in alcohol consumption.
Yeah. Well, what is it about bubbles that make them so much fun? And why do we have bubbles? Why are there bubbles, or why do we really work to get bubbles in champagne?
Well, the bubbles in champagne come from
natural?
Come from the fermentation process, grapes. And the fermentation process that involves yeast and sugar and so on results in, among other products, tiny gas bubbles. They are compressed. So when you open the popping of the champagne bottle, that's another very beautiful.
We got a pop? Should we get Tyler? You got a pop there? You got a champagne? Don't you have a glass pouring? Oh, yeah, you do. I think.
But the popping sound by itself is aesthetically pleasing. It startled some people if you're not paying attention to it. That's because you are opening the contained vessel, the bottle in this case, to the atmosphere, and the pressure of the gas, of the carbon dioxide gas inside, is much higher than atmospheric pressure. And then when you pour the champagne into the glass, into the flute, you begin to see near the bottom of the glass, you begin to see tiny bubbles form.
Tiny bubbles, like the song.
Yes, yes. And these bubbles rise to the top, and then when they get to the surface, they become part of the atmosphere. Now, everyone who has enjoyed carbonated beverages, those are the beverages that have carbon dioxide in them. They're not all alcoholic. Everyone knows that when the drink goes flat, there is no more carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And it doesn't taste as good.
No.
So the temperature is, for champagne, it has to be around 10 to 12 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, about 50 to 54 degrees Fahrenheit for us to really enjoy it. And we can swirl the champagne in our mouth and feel the smoothness on our tongue. There are all kinds of different ways to enjoy champagne. It is to be sipped. Not
gulped down.
No guzzling. Yes.
You know, Kellen Wazika has a question that relates right to what we're talking about here, I think. So let's see what's on Kel's mind. Hi, Kel. Kel, are you there?
Are you looking for Pat and Wazika?
Pat and Wazika? Oh, okay. Pat, go right ahead.
All right. My champagne is my favorite choice of drink, but diagnosed as diabetic, I started cutting out soft drinks, but I couldn't take in enough water, so I started carbonating my water with one of those appliances that are wonderful. But after I bought like six cylinders of carbon dioxide gas for the appliance, I'm wondering, that gas just goes up into the atmosphere, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I'm increasing my carbon output?
Your carbon footprint.
What a wonderful question for all of us to think about. Is consuming carbonated beverages contributing to increasing carbon dioxide in the environment and thus contributing significantly to global warming?
Mm-hmm.
My answer to your question is no. It is, the amounts are so insignificant compared to what we produce when we burn fossil fuels. And so enjoy your carbonated beverage. Be responsible if it is alcoholic, as I mentioned before, in how much is consumed. But carbonation in sodas, in carbonated beverages, their contribution to global warming is not even, it's almost non-deductible.
And non-measurable, okay.
But I really appreciate your sense of responsibility about the connection,
Pat,
between carbon dioxide and global warming.
Pat, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we had and by the way, you can join in too with your own questions about bubbles or any other science question you might have. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. JT and Menominee emailed that there are certain beverages appearing more frequently during the St. Patrick's Day season that have nitrogen bubbles. How do they differ in purpose or property from the bubbles in other beverages?
Well, carbon dioxide, all bubbles contribute to, in drinks, contribute to our pleasant, they give us a pleasant sensation when we put the liquid in our mouths, because the tiny gas bubbles come out of the liquid and tingle us under the tongue. That's the pleasant sensation that we do not experience when the drink is flat. Now, there are certain beers And there are certain soft drinks that have nitrogen added to them. And the purpose there is to increase the bubbling effect. However, part of the joy of enjoying carbonated beverages has to do with what carbon dioxide itself does. There is an enzyme in the saliva. It's called carbonic anhydrase. And when the carbon dioxide is in our mouth, the interaction with that enzyme in our saliva greatly contributes to the sensation, the pleasant sensation that we have.
Okay.
Nitrogen does not interact with carbonic anhydrase.
Here's another email from Grant. He's a longtime bread baker who bakes naturally fermented breads. He uses his own culture starter, and he knows that wild yeast produces CO2 in the dough. But do the bacteria in the dough produce gas in the dough as well?
Is it carbon dioxide gas?
Does it produce?
The carbon dioxide gas is produced. Baking powder is used to produce bubbles, and this is why we enjoy the souffle. So their bubbles are either in liquids or they are in solids, and so in baking, the bubble is in the solid. It expands the solid. You know, that's how the souffles, cakes, all baking that involves baking powder involves carbon dioxide. And so, you know, carbon dioxide is really all around us. I don't know exactly what the other gases are, but you know what? I'll do the usual thing I do when I get a question I don't know the answer to. I will look into it and post that on my website. And my website is www.scifun.org, scifun.org. And I'm really curious what the other gases are.
That's a good question. Well, I'm glad that Grant sent that in, because that's really cool. And, you know, when I make my pancakes, Saturday morning is kind of pancake morning for daughter Emily, because she loves pancakes. And you make that batter, you get that batter ready. I stir it around, and then I might fry up some bacon or put some sausages in the fry pan, and then I'll go back and look at the batter, and here comes some bubbles coming up from the batter.
Carbon dioxide bubbles. Carbon dioxide bubbles. All of that calls our attention to learn more about carbon dioxide, its properties, its use, and its effect on the environment. Once again, what we do in baking and in consuming carbonated beverages does not contribute much, hardly at all, to global warming. But carbon dioxide, Larry, you know this, and people in the listening audience know this too. Carbon dioxide gas is a greenhouse gas.
Yep.
And we know that the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere are higher and increasing much faster than at any time in the past. That's because we're using fossil fuels, and we burn fossil fuels that contain carbon, among other things. We form carbon dioxide. The amounts of carbon dioxide that human activity puts in the atmosphere is responsible to the very noticeable and harmful global warming. And that's why we need to learn more about carbon dioxide, its properties, its behavior, and so on. And we need to take steps to mitigate global warming by changing our behavior so that we rely less on fossil fuels for sources of energy. And Larry, one other point about carbon dioxide, because people in Wisconsin and elsewhere, they've been to caves where they've seen stalagmites and stalagmites.
Yeah. Stalactites.
Stalactites and stalagmites. The stalagmites with the hard G are the ones that are coming from the earth and from the ground. And and the stalactites are the one dripping from the top. That's a very slow reaction between carbon dioxide, water, and calcium ions. that are present. And what you're forming there is you're forming the insoluble substance calcium carbonate. But the rate of that reaction inside the cave is very, very, very slow. So carbon dioxide is all around us. We should enjoy it in any way that we think is responsible. But we should pay very special attention to the effect of spewing out so much carbon dioxide from our over-reliance on fossil fuels, the combustion of which gives us energy but increases the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
But Sam Shakashiri, our guest today, callers online, David in Sun Prairie, we'll get to you in a minute, and Mike in Madison. But first, a reminder that Sam is a professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau's our producer, and Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you, of course, are listening to the Ideas Network. Ah, bubbles on our mind today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest from the UW-Madison Department of Chemistry, Sam Shakashiri. So we've talked about bubbles and CO2, and we'll take other, and we've gotten into global warming. So lots to talk about with him. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. And now let's go to David in Sun Prairie, who has a question. David, hello.
Yes, howdy. I'm part of Sun Prairie Home Ventures, and bubbles are, for most of us, considered a negative. We do things like vacuum degassing wine. Question is there an easy home test for how well we've pulled the CO2 out?
There are several tests. I don't know about easy, but winemakers, excuse me, and beer makers also, concerned about the point that you raise here. My suggestion is that you use your search engine and find something. Unless Larry, you know specifically,
but there should be a hand device that you should be able to test that.
Yeah, I just don't know if one myself. So since
I don't have one off the top of my head either. Yeah. I've got a wine show coming up. I'll have to ask the winemaker how he if there is an easy way.
This is a common question that comes up every now and then. I just don't have. I'm not a winemaker. I just don't know which one to recommend. There's several of them.
Oh, there are. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. There you go, David. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Yes. Thank you. And all the talk is about taxing carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuel as a way to get people to reduce their driving and get more efficient. I never hear anything about a proposal that I've tried push for, and that is providing the government would, at the state or federal level, would provide incentives that would be positive financial incentives, not taxes. It would be like annual checks for people who are drive very low miles. I drive 1,000 miles a year at most. Who don't fly and who use less electricity that's produced by burning fossil fuels compared to the average family.
So what do you think of something like that? So, I think Mike's trying to come up with a positive way as opposed to maybe a negative way of getting down the consumption of greenhouse gases.
I think that's a topic that is of great interest, and many organizations are working on it. Mm. Let me just mention a couple for example, the Union of Concerned Scientists have specific suggestions on their website. Union of Concerned Scientists is the name of the organization. The Citizens Climate Lobby, which lobbies Congress for the carbon tax, is another one. There's another a group. It's a very good website. I recommend it very highly. It's called Project Drawdown. DRAWDOWN, Project Drawdown. They have many recommendations along the lines that Mike is talking about. Yes. So this is where I refer you. But, you know, we each can take individual action as well. The first thing we can try to do is to increase our own knowledge of carbon dioxide and its effect on climate change. We can commit to taking responsible action to help mitigate climate change. We can engage with family and friends and others in respectful conversations about global warming, because that's what Mike is talking about, is how do we individually try to do this. We can do more along the lines that he's suggesting. We can switch to a car that has better fuel economy, or even better, go, you know, to an
electric. Like he does. Yeah. No, don't drive very much.
Well, yeah, but
use public transportation.
Yeah, but we're not trying to deprive people from driving.
No.
We all have individual choices to make, and that has to be very, very much respected. But we can use electric cars, or we can use hybrid cars. You know, for people who want to do this and can do this, they can walk, they can bike. Use more public transportation. You know, as Mike said, you know, fly less. I'm not saying stop flying, but be selective about the trips that you make. We can also, you know, eat less meat. Now I'm not saying we should stop eating meat. Eat less meat. Maybe introduce a vegetarian dish into the meal that we have. This has a direct effect on how much water is consumed to produce the beef. That's why I mentioned it as an example. So change the light bulbs, you know, and switch to LEDs. You did the switch, right?
I did, yeah. Switched everyone.
Right. Yeah. And let's all buy less stuff. I'm not anti-business. Please don't misunderstand. But we buy so many things that we don't actually end up using. So be selective, be careful, be thoughtful about what we do. Thank you, Mike.
And let's turn to Nick in Sheboygan. Nick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We love you a lot. My kids and I both love you. But my question for you is, like, we're into science big time. Like, we're all ham operators. And my question for you is there any, like, type of books or anything you can suggest to do experiments at home? Nothing to blow up the house, but, you know, like you said, we're all into science.
So. Oh, but Sam, you've got some right on your website.
Well, Nick, have you visited my website, scifun.org, scifun.org? Have you been there?
I have not. I work a lot of hours, so I'm working on it, but, you know.
Let me invite you and others in the listening audience to visit my website. In the upper left corner, you will find where you can click on experiments you can do at home. They are just
a bunch of them.
Very, very well researched, developed by me and by my group. Everything has been tested. They're all safe to do at home. So that's one source of doing experiments at home. And on that same website, you'll see references to other locations that are sources of information for doing science experiments. We all enjoy doing science experiments. You know, when you open the can of beer, there's science happening right in front of you. When you blow soap bubbles, as we have been talking before, all kinds of phenomena are in front of you. Colors on the surface, on that thin surface, that thin skin of the bubble before it. You know, what causes that color? We all ask questions, and so science experiments, as I invite you and others to visit my website. Make us become more engaged in the experiential activities that contribute to our joy, to our growth, to our development, and to taking responsible action for what we do.
So there you know, go, Nick. Scifun.org, scifun.org. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood has something for you, Bissam. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. This is so timely for me. I'm not a person who grew up drinking carbonated beverages. And then later on, I started drinking carbonated water. And I noticed that I'd often feel kind of weak and tired. And I mean, so much so that I did ask my doctor about it, and she said she didn't know. So I'm wondering, can you tell me if there are some people who could be affected by carbonation and what may be happening?
I'm with your doctor. I don't know. But I kind of think that maybe the carbonation per se is not what's going on here. I simply don't know. This is a medical question and completely out of my sphere of knowledge. But, you know, the carbonated beverages have a lot of other things in them, unless it is just seltzer. Seltzer has carbonation, low sodium. So I honestly don't know what's going on there.
Chris, and Christina, she had switched brands, but now it's okay. So it might have been something just in the brand of water that she was using. It's really, really hard to say.
Could be, yeah.
Christina, that's as far as we can go with you. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Patricia in Spring Green, it is your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. Well, going back to the subject of the reward and punishment for a small carbon footprint, I moved back to Wisconsin after 15 years in Washington, D.C., where I had an extremely small carbon footprint. I got rid of my car for 12 years. I drove, I walked everywhere, used transit. Anyway, recycled everything that's good to do. Was moving back to Wisconsin, so I had to get a car, decided to bite the bullet and get the Tesla, which is very expensive, but I wanted to keep up my low-carbon footprint to the degree that I could, and was shocked to learn that I would be punished by having to pay an extra $100 a year on my vehicle registration for driving an all-electric car. Now I can understand the logic behind it is that I'm not buying gas, therefore I'm expected to pick up my share of the road taxes. So I can kind of understand the logic of it, but it seems like a faulty way to encourage good behavior.
Patricia, I drive a hybrid car, and I have a similar experience, yes.
Not only, yeah, I do, too.
Not only cost more, but there was an additional fee when the car was registered. Taxation is part of the way by which our government, whether local, state, or federal, makes statements to us about what we should be paying for. I am with you completely about the surprise. Frankly, I don't view it as punishment. I understand why you say punishment. I'm not disagreeing with you. I just don't view it as being punishment. It's what we have to do is we've had taxes on tobacco, we've had taxes on alcohol, we have taxes when we drive on the interstate, you know, with the I-Pass or whichever one it is that you're using. All of these are fees, and whether they are appropriate, whether they are to be continued or discontinued, that is up to us as voting citizens. We have to make our concerns, our opinions shared with our elected officials so they can make the appropriate changes. I am hoping that with a concerted effort on the part of people like you and I and Larry and others who feel strongly about wanting to mitigate climate change, that these extra fees, taxes, punishment, as you call them, something will be done about them. Something good will be done about them.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Here's an email from Steve. Caught my attention. He's hired two young people, 20 and 21, to work for him. They're great hard workers, but they believe the earth is flat. NASA is trying to hide it. Gravity is a lie and vaccines are bad. Steve wants to know how he can deal with these beliefs. It's really making it hard to work with them.
Thank you, Steve, for your question. Steve, when you and I and everyone else looks outside, we see that the Earth is flat. Don't you? Right? Yeah. It is flat. So what we have to do, what we should consider doing, is learning about the information and knowledge that is available to us. So that we ask the question, how do we know that the Earth is not flat? What is it in the human experience, personal and collective, that tells us that the Earth is not flat? And, you know, when Columbus set sail, some people thought that he's going to fall off at the edge of the water. So there are all kinds of misconceptions. So you have a wonderful opportunity with your two young, hardworking people. You have a wonderful opportunity to introduce them and to guide them, to ask questions and to look for responses and answers. And at the same time, they, like everyone else, should be skeptical of whatever answer is provided. This is how we make progress in science. This is how we make progress in improving our knowledge. We're skeptical about what we hear, but we examine evidence. We look at it carefully. We listen to what other people say about it. It's the process of inquiry. If your two young people want to have a closed mind and don't want to have a discussion about it, find ways to have a discussion about it. It's very, very important for all of us at all ages, to have a positive attitude, to be open-minded, and to listen to what other people are saying and what they're thinking, including people who think that the Earth is flat, including people who think that Neil Armstrong did not land on the moon. We have to try to succeed in combating ignorance, and we have to do it in guiding, responsible ways, and also be respectful of the people.
It's a tough challenge Steve has got there, though. You know, and he probably would take a look at why they think the way they do as well and sort of understand from their point of view maybe before he even brings it up.
That's why we have schools, Larry. That's why we have conversations in classes about science, about exploration. That's why we and how we try to satisfy the curiosity that we have. You know, we wake up in the middle of the night, we look up, and there's stars. And then we wait a little longer, and then we see light. You know, people talk about sunrise. Larry, you know the sun doesn't rise, right? it's just a figure of speech.
Yeah.
It's a movement of the earth. And those are the kinds of questions that these two young men would greatly enjoy having a conversation about.
Let's take another call. Owen in Wauwega. We'll go to you next. Hi, Owen.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to try to enlighten the public a little bit about what's going on here in the dairy industry. I'm a young beginning dairy farmer. I want to farm in the right way. I want to use regenerative agriculture. I want to graze my cattle. I want to keep my herd size small. I want to do a lot of things that are going to help reduce the carbon footprint of dairy farming. And my big concern is we're looking at a consolidated dairy industry in the state of Wisconsin that's continuing to need more assistance from taxpayers to try to increase their exports so they can stay in business and continue to maintain a profit. My concern is this: if we continue to embrace that type of dairy model and focus on exports, which we at this point in time we've found are extremely volatile and may not be sustainable in the future, we're going to continue to increase our carbon footprint impact, and the consumers, I believe, are starting to really find milk not to be an attractive product because of the consolidation dairy model that's being used, and we don't need to continue to focus on larger farmers. We need to continue to focus on trying to help beginning farmers farm the land in a way that's going to return the earth to a better state than we found it.
I applaud what you're saying. I applaud it. And I ask you to continue to raise your voice. Don't shout. Just raise your voice. Express yourself just like you did here very eloquently, locally in your own community. Look, this is an election year. We have awesome responsibilities as citizens to express ourselves, to elect people who will actually represent our own interests and do good for the communities where we live and do good for protecting the planet along the lines that you mentioned. Thank you for bringing this up.
Yeah, thanks, Owen. I appreciate your call. I wanted to switch gears a bit because the sesquicentennial of the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, it's the year, isn't it?
This is the year.
And talk about that organization for a minute, what it does. And it's such a valuable organization.
The Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters is 150 years old. That speaks to the great progressiveness of our state, of the people in our state. It is an organization, it's an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to creating a better world by connecting Wisconsin people with each other and also promoting the Wisconsin idea. The headquarters are here in Madison, but there are programs all over the state. They publish a quarterly magazine. It's a beautiful magazine. Members of the academy are invited to attend a variety of events all the way in the northern part of the state, on the east side of the state, and west side, everywhere. People are invited to participate in writing contests. There are it is the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. So poetry, writing are part, very important part of what they do. And so I invite people to consider joining the Academy and supporting the Academy activities, because the Academy success depends on people and the quality of ideas that are shared by people. And it's a really important, especially on this sesquicentennial, 150 years.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Larry, I know you've been on the air for 50 years. This is three times longer than you've been on the air. And we want the Academy to continue with success. And they're having a big gala celebration tomorrow night
yeah,
at the Wisconsin State Historical Society. How appropriate.
What a perfect place.
That's right, for that's marking the sesquicentennial. And you know, part of the celebrations tomorrow, guess what? Bubbles. Champagne bubbles.
That's the perfect time. That's the perfect spot to end this. But Sam, thank you so much. And again, I just want to remind you, go to his website, scifun.org, scifun.org. He will be answering some questions that came up that he didn't have an answer right off the top of his head for. And you can look at some of the experiments you can do with your kids or maybe your grandkids, or if you're taking care of kids. It's a perfect thing to do. There's lots there, and I love the website, so it's a great place to go. And Bassam will be back, and he'll talk with us again. You know, we had another science-minded fella coming up. He was been a conservationist, also been a police officer, and talking about letters that science was that Bassam was mentioning. He's also turned into a writer, so. How does a guy with a career as a conservation person and a police officer wind up as a mystery writer writing about saving wetlands? We'll find out. Jeff Nania recently published his second mystery novel, Spider Lake. We'll talk to him about how he got to writing it, and certainly talk about his conservation efforts. Have you read his books? I hope you'll join in. And we'll be back with Jeff in just a second. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.